From Russia with Love by Ian Fleming. Concluded. Disc 7.
Fine, said Bond easily. What had there been in those few words that had set his spine tingling? Was it the note of authority in Nash's voice? The idea came to Bond that Nash might have gone mad. Perhaps it was madness in the room and not danger that Bond could smell. His instincts about this man had been right. It would be a question of somehow getting rid of him at the next station. Where had they got to? When would the frontier come? Bond lifted his wrist to look at the time. The violet light defeated the phosphorus numerals. Bond tilted the face towards the strip of moonlight from the window. From the direction of Nash there came a sharp click. Bond felt a violent blow on his wrist. Splinters of glass hit him in the face. His arm was flung back against the door. He wondered if his wrist had been broken. He let his arm hang and flexed his fingers. They all moved. The book was still open on Nash's lap, but now a thin wisp of smoke was coming out of the hole at the top of its spine, and there was a faint smell of fireworks in the room. The saliva dried in Bond's mouth as if he had swallowed alum. So there had been a trap all along, and the trap had closed. Captain Nash had been sent to him by Moscow, not by M, and the MGB agent in Number 9, the man with an American passport, was a myth, and Bond had given Nash his gun. He had even put wedges under the doors so that Nash would feel more secure. Bond shivered, not with fear, with disgust. Nash spoke. His voice was no longer a whisper, no longer oily. It was loud and confident. "That will save us a great deal of argument, old man. Just a little demonstration. They think I'm pretty good with this little bag of tricks. There are 10 bullets in it, 2 5-dum-dum fired by an electric battery. You must admit the Russians are wonderful chaps for dreaming these things up. Too bad that book of yours is only for reading, old man. For God's sake, stop calling me old man." When there was so much to know, so much to think about, this was Bond's first reaction to utter catastrophe. It was the reaction of someone in a burning house who picks up the most trivial object to save from the flames.
"Sorry, old man. It's got to be a habit. Part of trying to be a bloody gentleman. Like these clothes. All from the wardrobe department. They said I'd get by like this, and I did, didn't I, old man? But let's get down to business. I expect you'd like to know what this is all about. Be glad to tell you. We've got about 30 minutes before you're due to go. It'll give me an extra kick telling the famous Mr. Bond of the Secret Service what a bloody fool he is. You see, old man, you're not so good as you think. You're just a stuffed dummy, and I've been given the job of letting the sawdust out of you."
The voice was even and flat, the sentences trailing away on a dead note. It was as if Nash was bored by the act of speaking. "Yes," said Bond, "I'd like to know what it's all about. I can spare you 30 minutes. Desperately, he wondered. Was there any way of putting this man off his stride, upsetting his balance? "Don't kid yourself, old man." The voice was uninterested in Bond, or in the threat of Bond. Bond didn't exist, except as a target.
"You're going to die in 30 minutes. No mistake about it. I've never made a mistake, or I wouldn't have my job."
"What is your job?"
"Chief Executioner of SMESH."
There was a hint of life in the voice, a hint of pride. The voice went flat again. "You know the name, I believe, old man." SMESH. So that was the answer. The worst answer of all, and this was their chief killer. Bond remembered the red glare that flickered in the opaque eyes. A killer, a psychopath, manic-depressive, probably. A man who really enjoyed it. What a useful man for SMESH to have found. Bond suddenly remembered what Vavra had said. He tried a long shot. "Does the moon have any effect on you, Nash?" The black lips writhed.
"Clever, aren't you, Mr. Secret Service? Think I'm balmy? Don't worry. I wouldn't be where I am if I was balmy."
The angry sneer in the man's voice told Bond that he had touched a nerve. But what could he achieve by getting the man out of control? Better humour him and gain some time. Perhaps Tatiana. "Where does the girl come into all this?"
"Part of the bait."
The voice was bored again.
"Don't worry. She won't butt in on our talk. Fed her a pinch of chloral hydrate when I poured her that glass of wine. She'll be out for the night. And then for every other night. She's to go with you."
"Oh, really?" Bond slowly lifted his aching hand onto his lap, flexing the fingers to get the blood moving. "Well, let's hear the story."
Careful, old man. No tricks. No Bulldog Drummond stuff will get you out of this one. If I don't like even the smell of a move, it'll be just one bullet through the heart. Nothing more. That's what you'll be getting in the end. One through the centre of the heart. If you move, it'll come a bit quicker. And don't forget who I am. Remember your wristwatch? I don't miss. Not ever.
Good show, said Bond carelessly. But don't be frightened. You've got my gun, remember? Get on with your story.
All right, old man. Only don't scratch your ear while I'm talking, or I'll shoot it off, see?
Well, Smirsch decided to kill you. At least I gather it was decided even higher up, right at the top. Seems they want to take one good hard poke at the Secret Service. Bring them down a peg or two, follow me?
Why choose me?
Don't ask me, old man. They say you've got quite a reputation in your outfit. The way you're going to be killed is going to bust up the whole show. It's been 3 months cooking, this plan, and it's a beaut. Got to be. Smash has made one or two mistakes lately. That Koklov business, for one. Remember the explosive cigarette case and all that? Gave the job to the wrong man. Should have given it to me. They wouldn't have gone over to the Yanks. However, to get back. You see, old man, we've got quite a planner in Smash. Man called Kronstein. Great chess player. He said vanity would get you, and greed, and a bit of craziness in the plot. He said you'd all fall for the craziness in London. And you did, didn't you, old man?
Had they?
Bond remembered just how much the eccentric angles of the story had aroused their curiosity. And vanity? Yes, he had to admit that the idea of this Russian girl being in love with him had helped. And there had been the spector. That had decided the whole thing, playing greed for it. He said noncommittally, "We were interested."
Then came the operation. Our head of operations is quite a character. I'd say she's killed more people than anyone in the world, or arranged for them to be killed. Yes, it's a woman. Name of Kleb. Rosa Kleb. Real swine of a woman, but she certainly knows all the tricks.
Rosa Kleb. So at the top of Smash there was a woman. If he could somehow survive this and get after her. The fingers of Bond's right hand curled softly. The flat voice in the corner went on.
Well, she found this Romanova girl. Trained her for the job. By the way, how was she in bed?
Pretty good. No. Bond didn't believe it. That first night must have been staged. But afterwards? No, afterwards had been real. He took the opportunity to shrug his shoulders. It was an exaggerated shrug to get the man accustomed to movement. Oh, well. Not interested in that sort of thing myself. But they got some nice pictures of you two. Nash tapped his coat pocket. Whole reel of 16mm. That's going into her handbag. It'll look fine in the papers.
Nash laughed, a harsh, metallic laugh. They'll have to cut some of the juiciest bits, of course.
The change of rooms at the hotel, the honeymoon suite, the big mirror behind the bed, how well it all fitted. Bond felt his hands wet with perspiration. He wiped them down his trousers.
Steady, old man. You nearly got it, then. I told you not to move, remember?
Bond put his hands back on the book in his lap. How much could he develop these small movements? How far could he go?
Get on with the story, he said. Did the girl know these pictures were being taken? Did she know Smash was involved in all this?
Nash snorted.
Of course she didn't know about the pictures. Rosa didn't trust her yard. Too emotional. But I don't know much about that side. We all worked in compartments. I'd never seen her until today. I only know what I picked up. Yes, of course the girl knew she was working for Smirsch. She was told she had to get to London and do a bit of spying there.
The silly idiot, thought Bond. Why the hell hadn't she told him that Smirsch was involved? She must have been frightened even to speak the name. Thought he would have her locked up or something. She had always said she would tell him everything when she got to England. That he must have faith and not be afraid. Faith, when she hadn't the foggiest idea herself what was going on. Oh, well, poor child. She had been as fooled as he had been. But any hint would have been enough. He would have saved the life of Kerim, for instance. And what about hers and his own?
Then this Turk of yours had to be got rid of. I gather that took a bit of doing.
Tough not. I suppose it was his gang that blew up our centre in Istanbul yesterday afternoon.
That's going to create a bit of a panic.
Too bad.
Doesn't worry me, old man. My end of the job's going to be easy.
Nash took a quick glance at his wristwatch. In about 20 minutes we go into the Saint-Plan tunnel. That's where they want it done. More drama for the papers.
One bullet for you, as we go into the tunnel. Just one in the heart. The noise of the tunnel will help in case you're a noisy dyer. A rattle and so forth. Then one in the back of the neck for her, with your gun. And out of the window she goes. Then one more for you, with your gun. With your fingers wrapped round it, of course. Plenty of powder on your shirt. Suicide. That's what it'll look like at first. But there'll be two bullets in your heart. That'll come out later. More mystery. Search the sample on again. Who was the man with the fair hair? They'll find the film in her bag, and in your pocket there'll be a long love letter from her to you. A bit threatening. It's a good one. Smersh wrote it. It says that she'll give the film to the newspapers unless you marry her, that you promised to marry her if she stole the spectre. Nash paused and added in parenthesis, "As a matter of fact, old man, the spectre's booby-trapped. When your cipher experts start fiddling with it, it's going to blow them all to glory. Not a bad dividend on the side." Nash chuckled dully. "And then the letter says that all she's got to offer you is the machine and her body, and all about her body, and what you did with it. Hot stuff, that part, right? So what's the story in the papers? The left-wing ones, that will be tipped off to meet the train? Old man, the story's got everything. Orient Express, beautiful Russian spy murdered in Simplon Tunnel, filthy pictures, secret cipher machine, handsome British spy with career ruined murders her and commits suicide. Sex, spies, luxury train, Mr. and Mrs. Somerset. Old man, it'll run for months. Talk of the Cocklove case. This'll knock spots off it. And what a poke in the eye for the famous intelligence service. Their best man, the famous James Bond. What a shambles. And bang goes the cipher machine. What's your chief going to think of you? What's the public going to think? And the government? And the Americans? Talk about security. No more atom secrets from the Yanks.
Nash paused and let it all sink in. With a touch of pride, he said, "Old man, this is going to be the story of the century."
Yes, thought Bond, yes. He was certainly right about that. The French papers would give it such a send-off, there'd be no stopping it. They wouldn't mind how far they went with the pictures or anything else. There wasn't a press in the world that wouldn't pick it up. And the spectre, would M's people or the Deuxième have the sense to guess it was booby-trapped? How many of the best cryptographers in the West would go up with it? God, he must get out of this jam. But how? The top of Nash's War and Peace yawned at him. Let's see. There would be the roar as the train went into the tunnel, then at once the muffled click and the bullet. Bond's eyes stared into the violet gloom, measuring the depth of the shadow in his corner under the roof of the top bunk, remembering exactly where his attaché case stood on the floor, guessing what Nash would do after he had fired. Bond said, "You took a bit of a gamble on my letting you team up at Trieste. How did you know the code of the month?" Nash said patiently, "You don't seem to get the picture, old man. Smersh is good. Really good. There's nothing better. We know your code of the month for every year. If anyone in your show noticed these things, noticed the pattern of them like my show does, you'd realize that every January you lose one of your small chaps somewhere, maybe Tokyo, maybe Timbuktu. Smersh just picks one and takes him. Then they screw the code for the year out of him. Anything else he knows, of course, but it's the code they're after. Then it's passed round the centres. Simple as falling off a log, old man."
Bond dug his nails into the palms of his hands. "As for picking you up at Trieste, old man, I didn't. Rode down with you, in the front of the train. Got out as we stopped and walked back up the platform. You see, old man, we were waiting for you in Belgrade. Knew you'd call your chief, or the embassy or someone. Been listening in on that Yugoslav's telephone for weeks. Pity we didn't understand the code word he shot through to Istanbul. Might have stopped the firework display, or anyway saved our chaps. But the main target was you, old man, and we certainly had you sewn up all right. You were in the killing bottle from the minute you got off that plane in Turkey. It was only a question of when to stuff the cork in."
Nash took another quick glance at his watch. He looked up. His grinning teeth glistened violet. "Pretty soon now, old man. It's just cork hour, minus 15. Bond thought, "We knew Smersh was good, but we never knew they were as good as this." The knowledge was vital. Somehow he must get it back. He must. Bond's mind raced round the details of his pitifully thin, pitifully desperate plan. He said, "Smersh seems to have thought things out pretty well. It must have taken a lot of trouble. There's only one thing." Bond let his voice hang in the air. "What's that, old man?" Nash
thinking of his report, was alert. The train began to slow down. Domodossola, the Italian frontier. What about customs? But Bond remembered there were no formalities for the through carriages until they got to France, to the frontier, Vallorbe. Even then, not for the sleeping cars. These expresses cut straight through Switzerland. It was only people who got out at Brieg or Lausanne who had to go through customs in the stations.
"Well, come on, old man."
Nash sounded hooked. "Not without a cigarette." "Okay, go ahead. But if there's a move he don't like, he'll be dead." Bond slipped his right hand into his hip pocket. He drew out his broad gunmetal cigarette case, opened it, took out a cigarette, took his lighter out of his trouser pocket, lit the cigarette and put the lighter back. He left the cigarette case on his lap, beside the book. He put his left hand casually over the book and the cigarette case, as if to prevent them slipping off his lap. He puffed away at his cigarette. If only it had been a trick one. Magnesium flare, or anything he could throw in the man's face. If only his service went in for those explosive toys. But at least he had achieved his objective and hadn't been shot in the process. That was a start. "You see," Bond described an airy circle with his cigarette to distract Nash's attention. His left hand slipped the flat cigarette case between the pages of his book. "You see, it looks all right, but what about you? What are you going to do after we come out of the Simplon? The conductor knows you're mixed up with us. They'll be after you in a flash."
"Oh, that." Nash's voice was bored again. "You don't seem to have hoisted in that the Russians think these things out. I get off at Dijon and take a car to Paris. I get lost there. A bit of third-man stuff won't do the story any harm. Anyway, it'll come out later when they dig the second bullet out of you and can't find the second gun. They won't catch up with me. Matter of fact, I've got a date at noon tomorrow. Room 204 at the Ritz Hotel, making my report to Rosa. She wants to get the kudos for this job. Then I turn into her chauffeur and we drive to Berlin. Come to think of it, old man." The flat voice showed emotion, became greedy. "I think she may have the Order of Lenin for me in her bag. Lovely grub, as they say."
The train began to move. Bond tensed. In a few minutes it would come. What a way to die, if he was going to die. Through his own stupidity, blind, lethal stupidity, and lethal for Tatiana. Christ. At any moment he could have done something to dodge this shambles. There had been no lack of opportunity. But conceit and curiosity and 4 days of love had sucked him along on the easy stream down which it had been planned that he should drift. That was the damnable part of the whole business, the triumph for Smash, the one enemy he had always sworn to defeat wherever he met it. We will do this, and he will do that. "Comrades, it is easy with a vain fool like this Bond. Watch him take the bait. You will see. I tell you he's a fool. All Englishmen are fools." And Tatiana, the lure, the darling lure, Bond thought of their first night, the black stockings and the velvet ribbon. And all the time Smersh had been watching, watching him go through his conceited paces, as it had been planned that he would, so that the smear could be built up, the smear on him, the smear on M, who had sent him to Istanbul, the smear on the service that lived on the myth of its name. God, what a mess. If only his tiny grain of a plan might work. Ahead, the rumble of the train became a deep boom, a few more seconds, a few more yards. The oval mouth between the white pages seemed to gape wider. In a second the dark tunnel would switch out the moonlight on the pages and the blue tongue would lick out for him.
"Sweet dreams, you English bastard."
The rumble became a great, swift, clanging roar. The spine of the book bloomed flame. The bullet, homing on Bond's heart, flashed over its 2 quiet yards. Bond pitched forward onto the floor and lay sprawled under the funeral violet light. Chapter 27. 10 Pints of Blood. It had all depended on the man's accuracy. Nash had said that Bond would get 1 bullet through the heart. Bond had taken the gamble that Nash's aim was as good as he said it was, and it had been. Bond lay like a dead man lies. Before the bullet, he had recalled the corpses he had seen, how their bodies had looked in death. Now he lay totally collapsed, like a broken doll, his arms and legs carefully outflung. He explored his sensations. Where the bullet had crashed into the book, his ribs were on fire. The bullet must have gone through the cigarette case and then through the other half of the book. He could feel the hot lead over his heart. It felt as if it was burning inside his ribs. It was only a sharp pain in his head where it hit the woodwork, and the violet sheen on the scuffed toe-caps against his nose that said he wasn't dead. Like an archaeologist, Bond explored the carefully planned ruin of his body. The position of the sprawled feet, the angle of the half-bent knee that would give purchase when it was needed, the right hand that seemed to be clawing at his pierced heart was within inches, when he could release the book, of the little attaché case, within inches of the lateral stitching that held the flat-bladed throwing knives, two-edged and sharp as razors, that he had mocked when Q Branch had demonstrated the catch that held them, and his left hand, outflung in the surrender of death, rested on the floor, and would provide upward leverage when the moment came. Above him there sounded a long, cavernous yawn. The brown toe-caps shifted. Bond watched the shoe-leather strain as Nash stood up. In a minute, with Bond's gun in his right hand, Nash would climb onto the bottom bunk and reach up and feel through the curtain of hair for the base of the girl's neck. Then the snout of the Beretta would nuzzle in after the probing fingers. Nash would press the trigger. The roar of the train would cover the muffled boom. It would be a near thing. Bond desperately tried to remember simple anatomy. Where were the mortal places in the lower body of a man? Where did the main artery run? The femoral. Down the inside of the thigh. And the external iliac, or whatever it was called, that became the femoral, across the centre of the groin. If he missed both, it would be bad. Bond had no illusions about being able to beat this terrific man in unarmed combat. The first violent stab of his knife had to be decisive. The brown toe-caps moved. They pointed towards the bunk. What was the man doing? There was no sound except the hollow iron clang as the great train tore through the Simplon, through the heart of the Wassenhorn and Monteleone. The tooth-glass tinkled. The woodwork creaked comfortably. For 100 yards on both sides of the little death cell, rows of people were sleeping or lying awake, thinking of their lives and loves, making little plans, wondering who would meet them at the Gare de Lyon. And all the while, just along the corridor, death was riding with them down the same dark hole, behind the same great diesel, on the same hot rails. One brown shoe left the floor. It would have stepped half across Bond. The vulnerable arch would be open above Bond's head. Bond's muscles coiled like a snake's. His right hand flickered a few centimetres to the hard stitching on the edge of the case, pressed sideways, felt the narrow shaft of the knife, drew it softly halfway out without moving his arm. The brown heel lifted off the ground, the toe bent and took the weight. Now the second foot had gone. Slowly move the weight here, take the purchase there, grasp the knife hard so that it wouldn't turn on a bone, and then, in one violent corkscrew of motion, Bond's body twisted up from the floor. The knife flashed. The fist with a long steel finger and all Bond's arm and shoulder behind it lunged upwards. Bond's knuckles felt flannel. He held the knife in, forcing it further. A ghastly wailing cry came down to him. The Beretta clattered to the floor. Then the knife was wrenched from Bond's hands as the man gave a convulsive twist and crashed down. Bond had planned for the fall, but as he sidestepped towards the window, a flailing hand caught him and sent him thudding onto the lower bunk. Before he could recover himself, up from the floor rose the terrible face, its eyes shining violet, the violet teeth bared. Slowly, agonizingly, the two huge hands groped for him. Bond, half on his back, kicked out blindly. His shoe connected, but then his foot was held and twisted, and he felt himself slipping downwards. Bond's fingers scrabbled for a hold in the stuff of the bunk. Now the other hand had him by the thigh. Nails dug into him. Bond's body was being twisted and pulled down. Soon the teeth would be at him. Bond hammered out with his free leg. It made no difference. He was going. Suddenly Bond's scrabbling fingers felt something hard. The book. How did one work the thing? Which way up was it? Would it shoot him or Nash? Desperately Bond held it out towards the great sweating face. He pressed at the base of the cloth spine. Click! Bond felt the recoil. Click! 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 Now Bond felt the heat under his fingers. The hands on his legs were going limp. The glistening face was drawing back. A noise came from the throat, a terrible gurgling noise. Then, with a slither and a crack, the body fell forward onto the floor, and the head crashed back against the woodwork. Bond lay and panted through clenched teeth. He stared up at the violet light above the door. He noticed that the loop of the filament waxed and waned. It crossed his mind that the dynamo under the carriage must be defective. He blinked his eyes to focus the light more closely. The sweat ran into them and stung. He lay still, doing nothing about it. The galloping boom of the train began to change. It sounded hollower. With a final echoing roar, the Orient Express sped out into the moonlight and slackened speed. Bond lazily reached up and pulled at the edge of the blind. He saw warehouses and sidings. Lights shone brightly, cleanly on the rails. Good, powerful lights, the lights of Switzerland. The train slid quietly to a stop. In the steady, singing silence, a small noise came from the floor. Bond cursed himself for not having made certain. He quickly bent down, listening. He held the book forward at the ready, just in case. No movement. Bond reached and felt for the jugular vein. No pulse. The man was quite dead. The corpse had been settling. Bond sat back and waited impatiently for the train to move again. There was a lot to be done. Even before he could see to Tatiana, there would have to be the cleaning up. With a jerk, the long express started softly rolling. Soon the train would be slaloming fast down the foothills of the Alps into the Canton Valais. Already there was a new sound in the wheels, a hurrying lilt, as if they were glad the tunnel was past. Bond got to his feet and stepped over the sprawling legs of the dead man and turned on the top light. What a shambles! The place looked like a butcher's shop. How much blood did a body contain? He remembered. 10 pints. Well, it would soon all be there, as long as it didn't spread into the passage. Bond stripped the bedclothes off the bottom bunk and set to work. At last the job was done, the walls swabbed down around the covered bulk on the floor, the suitcases ready for the getaway to Dijon. Bond drank down a whole carafe of water, then he stepped up and gently shook the shoulder of fur. There was no response. Had the man lied? Had he killed her with a poison? Bond thrust his hand in against her neck. It was warm. Bond felt for the lobe of an ear and pinched it hard. The girl stirred sluggishly and moaned. Again Bond pinched the ear, and again. At last a muffled voice said, "Don't." Bond smiled. He shook her. He went on shaking until Tatiana slowly turned over on her side. 2 doped blue eyes gazed into his and closed again.
"What is it?"
The voice was sleepily angry. Bond talked to her and bullied her and cursed her. He shook her more roughly. At last she sat up. She gazed vacantly at him. Bond pulled her legs out so that they hung down over the edge. Somehow he manhandled her down onto the bottom bunk. Tatiana looked terrible, the slack mouth, the upturned, sleep-drunk eyes, the tangle of damp hair. Bond got to work with a wet towel and her comb. Lausanne came, and an hour later the French frontier at Valorbe. Bond left Tatiana and went out and stood in the corridor just in case. But the customs and passport men brushed past him to the conductor's cabin, and after 5 inscrutable minutes went on down the train. Bond stepped back into the compartment. Tatiana was asleep again. Bond looked at Nash's watch, which was now on his own wrist. 4:30. Another hour to Dijon. Bond set to work. At last Tatiana's eyes opened wide. Her pupils were more or less centred. She said,
"Stop it now, James."
She closed her eyes again. Bond wiped the sweat off his face. He took the bags one by one to the end of the corridor and piled them against the exit. Then he went along to the corridor and told him that Madame was not well and that they would be leaving the train at Dijon. Bond gave the conductor a final tip. "Do not derange yourself," he said. "I have taken the luggage out so as not to disturb Madame. My friend, the one with fair hair, is a doctor. He's been sitting up with us all night. I've put him to sleep in my bunk. The man was exhausted. It would be kind not to waken him until 10 minutes before Paris."
"Certainement, monsieur."
The conductor had not been showered with money like this since the good old days of travelling millionaires. He handed over Bond's passport and tickets. The train began to slacken speed. "Voilà que nous sommes." Bond went back to the compartment. He dragged Tatiana to her feet and out into the corridor and shut the door on the white pile of death beside the bunk. At last they were down the steps and onto the hard, wonderful, motionless platform. A blue-smocked porter took their luggage. The sun was beginning to rise. At that hour of the morning there were very few passengers awake. Only a handful in the third class, who had ridden hard through the night, saw a young man help a young girl away from the dusty carriage, with the romantic names on its side, towards the drab door that said Sotti. Chapter 28, the last chapter. La Tricoteuse. The taxi drew up at the Rue Cambon entrance to the Ritz Hotel. Bond looked at Nash's watch. 11:45. He must be dead punctual. He knew that if a Russian spy was even a few minutes early or late for a rendezvous, the rendezvous was automatically cancelled. He paid off the taxi and went through the door on the left that leads into the Ritz bar. Bond ordered a double vodka martini. He drank it half down. He felt wonderful. Suddenly the last 4 days, and particularly last night, were washed off the calendar. Now he was on his own, having his private adventure. All his duties had been taken care of. The girl was sleeping in a bedroom at the embassy. The Spectre, still pregnant with explosive, had been taken away by the bomb disposal squad of the Deuxième Bureau. He had spoken to his old friend, René Matisse, now head of the Deuxième, and the concierge at the Cambon entrance to the Ritz had been told to give him a passkey and to ask no questions. René had been delighted to find himself again involved with Bond in Une Affaire Noire. "Have confidence, cher James," he had said. "I will execute your mysteries. You can tell me the story afterwards. Two laundrymen with a large laundry basket will come to room 204 at 12:15. I shall accompany them dressed as the driver of their camion. We are to fill the laundry basket and take it to Orly and await an RAF Canberra, which will arrive at 2 o'clock. We hand over the basket. Some dirty washing, which was in France, will be in England, yes?" Head of Station F had spoken to M on the scrambler. He had passed over a short written report from Bond. He had asked for the Canberra. No, he had no idea what it was for. Bond had only shown up to deliver the girl and the Spectre. He had eaten a huge breakfast and had left the embassy saying he would be back after lunch. Bond looked again at the time. He finished his martini. He paid for it and walked out of the bar and up the steps to the concierge's lodge. The concierge looked sharply at him and handed over a key. Bond walked over to the lift and got in and went up to the third floor. The lift door clanged behind him. Bond walked softly down the corridor, looking at the numbers. 204. Bond put his right hand inside his coat and onto the taped butt of the Beretta. It was tucked into the waistband of his trousers. He could feel the metal of the silencer warm across his stomach. He knocked once with his left hand. "Come in!" It was a quavering voice, an old woman's voice. Bond tried the handle of the door. It was unlocked. He slipped the pass-key into his coat pocket. He pushed the door open with one swift motion and stepped in and shut it behind him. It was a typical Ritz sitting-room, extremely elegant, with good Empire furniture. The walls were white, and the curtains and chair covers were of a small patterned chintz of red roses on white. The carpet was wine-red and close-fitted. In a pool of sunshine, in a low-armed chair beside a directoire writing-desk, a little old woman sat knitting. The tinkle of the steel needles continued. The eyes, behind light blue-tinted bifocals, examined Bond with polite curiosity.
"Oui, monsieur."
The voice was deep and hoarse. The thickly powdered, rather puffy face under the white hair showed nothing but well-bred interest. Bond's hand on the gun under his coat was taut as a steel spring. His half-closed eyes flickered round the room and back to the little old woman in the chair. Had he made a mistake? Was this the wrong room? Should he apologize and get out? Could this woman possibly belong to Smersh? She looked so exactly like the sort of respectable rich widow one would expect to find sitting by herself in the Ritz, whiling the time away with her knitting. The sort of woman who would have her own table and her favorite waiter in a corner of the restaurant downstairs, not, of course, the grill room. The sort of woman who would doze after lunch and then be fetched by an elegant black limousine with white side-walled tires and be driven to the tea-room in the Rue de Berry to meet some other rich crone. The old-fashioned black dress with a touch of lace at the throat and wrists, the thin gold chain that hung down over the shapeless bosom and ended in a folding lorgnette, the neat little feet in the sensible black-buttoned boots that barely touched the floor. It couldn't be Cleb. Bond had got the number of the room wrong. He could feel the perspiration under his arms, but now he would have to play the scene through. "My name is Bond. James Bond.
"'And I, monsieur, am the Comtesse Metterstein. What can I do for you?'
The French was rather thick. She might be German-Swiss. The needles tinkled busily. "'I'm afraid Captain Nash has met with an accident. He won't be coming today, so I came instead.' Did the eyes narrow a fraction behind the pale blue spectacles?
"'I have not the pleasure of the captain's acquaintance, monsieur, nor of yours. Please sit down and state your business.'
The woman inclined her head an inch towards the high-backed chair beside the writing-desk. One couldn't fault her. The graciousness of it all was devastating. Bond walked across the room and sat down. Now he was about 6 feet away from her. The desk held nothing but a tall, old-fashioned telephone with a receiver on a hook, and within reach of her hand an ivory-buttoned bell-push. The black mouth of the telephone yawned at Bond politely. Bond stared rudely into the woman's face, examining it. It was an ugly face, toad-like, under the powder, and under the tight cottage loaf of white hair. The eyes were so light brown as to be almost yellow. The pale lips were wet and blubbery below the fringe of nicotine-stained moustache. Nicotine? Where were her cigarettes? There was no ashtray, no smell of smoke in the room. Bond's hand tightened again on his gun. He glanced down at the bag of knitting, at the shapeless length of small denier beige wool the woman was working on. The steel needles. What was there odd about them? The ends were discoloured, as if they had been held in fire. Did knitting needles ever look like that?
Eh bien, monsieur!
Was there an edge to the voice? Had she read something in his face? Bond smiled. His muscles were tense, waiting for any movement, any trick. "'It's no use,' he said cheerfully, gambling. "'You are Rosa Klebb, and you are head of Otdiel II of Smash. You are a torturer and a murderer. You wanted to kill me and the Romanov girl. I am very glad to meet you at last.' The eyes had not changed. The harsh voice was patient and polite. The woman reached out her left hand towards the bell-push.
"'Monsieur, I am afraid you are deranged. I must ring for the valet de chambre and have you shown to the door.'
Bond never knew what saved his life. Perhaps it was the flash of realization that no wires led from the bell-push to the wall or into the carpet. Perhaps it was the sudden memory of the English "come in" when the expected knock came on the door.' But as her finger reached the ivory knob, he hurled himself sideways out of the chair. As Bond hit the ground, there was a sharp noise of tearing calico. Splinters from the back of his chair sprayed around him. The chair crashed to the floor. Bond twisted over, tugging at his gun. Out of the corner of his eye, he noticed a curl of blue smoke coming from the mouth of the telephone. Then the woman was on him, the knitting needles glinting in her clenched fists. She stabbed downwards at his legs. Bond lashed out with his feet and hurled her sideways. She had aimed at his legs. As he got to one knee, Bond knew what the coloured tips of the needles meant. It was poison. Probably one of those German nerve poisons. All she had to do was scratch him, even through his clothes. Bond was on his feet. She was coming at him again. He tugged furiously at his gun. The silencer had caught. There was a flash of light. Bond dodged. One of the needles rattled against the wall behind him, and the dreadful chunk of woman, the white bun of wig askew on her head, the slimy lips drawn back from her teeth, was on top of him. Bond, not daring to use his naked fists against the needles, vaulted sideways over the desk. Panting and talking to herself in Russian, Rosa Klebb scuttled round the desk, the remaining needle held forward like a rapier. Bond backed away, working at the stuck gun. The back of his legs came against a small chair. He let go the gun and reached behind him and snatched it up. Holding it by the back, with its legs pointing like horns, he went round the desk to meet her. But she was beside the bogus telephone. She swept it up and aimed it. Her hand went to the button. Bond leapt forward. He crashed the chair down. Bullets sprayed into the ceiling and plaster pattered down on his head. Bond lunged again. The legs of the chair clutched the woman round the waist and over her shoulders. God, she was strong. She gave way, but only to the wall. There she held her ground, spitting at Bond over the top of the chair, while the knitting needle quested towards him like a long scorpion sting. Bond stood back a little, holding the chair at arm's length. He took aim and high-kicked at the probing wrist. The needle sailed away into the room and pinged down behind him. Bond came in closer. He examined the position. Yes, the woman was held firmly against the wall by the four legs of the chair. There was no way she could get out of the cage except by brute force. Her arms and legs and head were free, but the body was pinned to the wall. The woman hissed something in Russian. She spat at him over the chair. Bond bent his head and wiped his face against his sleeve. He looked up and into the mottled face. "That's all, Rosa," he said. "The deuxième will be here in a minute. In an hour or so you'll be in London. You won't be seen leaving the hotel. You won't be seen going into England. In fact, very few people will see you again. From now on, you're just a number on a secret file. By the time we've finished with you, you'll be ready for the lunatic asylum." The face, a few feet away, was changing. Now the blood had drained out of it, and it was yellow, but not, thought Bond, with fear. The pale eyes looked levelly into his. They were not defeated. The wet, shapeless mouth lengthened in a grin.
"And where will you be when I am in the asylum, Mr. Bond?"
"Oh, getting on with my life?"
"I think not, Angliski spion."
Bond hardly noticed the words. He had heard the click of the door opening. A burst of laughter came from the room behind him.
"Eh bien!"
It was the voice of delight that Bond remembered so well.
"The 70th position! Now at last I have seen everything, and invented by an Englishman. James, this really is an insult to my countrymen."
"I don't recommend it," said Bond over his shoulder. "It's too strenuous. Anyway, you can take over now. I'll introduce you. Her name's Rosa. You'll like her. She's a big noise in Smersh. She looks after the murdering, as a matter of fact." Matthews came up. There were two laundrymen with him. The three of them stood and looked respectfully into the dreadful face.
"Rosa," said Matthews thoughtfully. "But this time a Rosa malheur."
"Well, well.
But I am sure she is uncomfortable in that position. You two, bring along the panier de fleurs. She will be more comfortable lying down."
The two men walked to the door. Bond heard the creak of the laundry basket. The woman's eyes were still locked in Bond's. She moved a little, shifting her weight. Out of Bond's sight, and not noticed by Mathis, who was still examining her face, the toe of one shiny buttoned boot pressed under the instep of the other. From the point of its toe there slid forward half an inch of thin knife blade. Like the knitting needles, the steel had a dirty bluish tinge. The two men came up and put the big square basket down beside Mathis.
"Take her,"
said Mathis. He bowed slightly to the woman.
"It has been an honour."
"Au revoir, Rosa," said Bond. The yellow eyes blazed briefly.
"Farewell, Mr. Bond."
The boot with its tiny steel tongue flashed out. Bond felt a sharp pain in his right calf. It was only the sort of pain you would get from a kick. He flinched and stepped back. The two men seized Rosa Klebb by the arms. Mathis laughed.
"My poor James," he said. "Count on Smersh to have the last word."
The tongue of dirty steel had withdrawn into the leather. Now it was only a harmless bundle of old woman that was being lifted into the basket. Mathis watched the lid being secured. He turned to Bond.
"It is a good day's work you have done, my friend," he said. "But you look tired. Go back to the embassy and have a rest, because this evening we must have dinner together, the best dinner in Paris, and I will find the loveliest girl to go with it."
Numbness was creeping up Bond's body. He felt very cold. He lifted his hand to brush back the comber of hair over his right eyebrow. There was no feeling in his fingers. They seemed as big as cucumbers. His hand fell heavily to his side. Breathing became difficult. Bond sighed to the depth of his lungs. He clenched his jaws and half-closed his eyes, as people do when they want to hide their drunkenness. Through his eyelashes he watched the basket being carried to the door. He prized his eyes open. Desperately he focused Mathis.
"I shan't need a girl, Renée," he said thickly.
Now he had to gasp for breath. Again his hand moved up towards his cold face. He had an impression of Mathis starting towards him. Bond felt his knees begin to buckle. He said, or thought he said, "I've already got the loveliest..." Bond pivoted slowly on his heel and crashed headlong to the wine-red floor. This concludes the reading of From Russia with Love by Ian Fleming. This book was read by Robert Whitfield. Blackstone patrons who enjoy this unabridged work also enjoy these Blackstone titles: Ian Fleming, The Man Behind James Bond, by Andrew Lycett, The Spy Wore Red, and The Well-Mannered Assassin, both by Aileen, Countess of Romanones. For a complete listing of similar titles, visit our award-winning, easy-to-search website at www.blackstoneaudio.com. If you would like to obtain a complete catalogue of our titles, or a monthly update telling you about new releases and our new collection of books on CD, write to Blackstone Audiobooks, P.O. Box 969, Ashland, Oregon, zip code 97520, or call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. You may also obtain the same information from our award-winning website. Our address, all in one word, is www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.